The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, there's two things I want to talk about today, and two things I want to talk about because I want to talk about the relationship between them. And the first, in simple language, can be talking about freedom or liberation. And that's kind of, many people understand that that's really central to this Buddhist practice. But the one that is not mentioned very much is the idea of vow, kind of idea of a commitment. And these two go together. So, but vow has a very interesting kind of part of the unfolding of practice for some people. When people first come to practice, they're interested. And the interest is what engages them. And that interest might be driven by a need, so a real hope that somehow this practice will make a difference for the need, the suffering that people have. As people practice, at some point, there becomes something in the family of commitment that happens. That people say, or decisiveness, or a clarity, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this, meditate every day. I'm going to give myself over, make somewhat a priority for my life. And exactly where that priority, how strong that priority is, or how strong that commitment is, or how big it is very individual. But at some point, it's like, okay, this is more than just an interest now. And for some people, it becomes a life. And but at some point, the commitment changes to something else, where it becomes something like a vow. And I'll talk more about what that means. But the many religions have vows. You know, people who are ordained take vows. People who get married have vows. A vow is something that is affirming an aspiration, a wish that arises from within. It's not something we take from the outside and put on like a coat, but rather it's a recognition that now something is, there's a call from the inside, the recognition that now there's something that is flowing, animating us, energizing us from the inside out. And the vow is the recognition that this is where I'd like to live. This is my orientation. This is my direction. And so this points to how with practice, the practice changes over time. We change over time with it. With the freedom, there's also a kind of correspondingly, I list a three-part step that goes on. The first is, in the beginning, a lot of the practice has to do with relaxing. Relaxing, for some people, is not spiritual enough, so we can call it calming. Maybe that helps. A settling, a tranquilizing, a calming of all the agitation, the busyness of the mind, the heart. Calming and relaxing has a lot to do with healing that which is fragmented or hurt or wounded inside of us. And so, but there's a relaxing that goes on. As the relaxing deepens, at some point, there's a letting go. So there's a clarity that some things that we've been doing are not something that we want to do anymore. And there's a letting go that happens. And that letting go is a choice. At some point, there's come to a point, okay, enough of this. I'll stop doing this. But then with enough letting go, there is release. And release is a whole different animal than letting go, because release is not something you can do, but rather something we allow for. So I want to talk about these two different things, so this freedom side and this vow side. So in the freedom side, letting go, sooner or later, becomes very important. Some of the letting go just happens. Some people are surprised as they meditate how much of their ordinary life and concerns just settle away and recede into the background. And if that's done clearly enough, strongly enough, there's... people experience themselves being alive in a very different way than they've ever done before. many people, or many, you know, maybe it, for some people, it's like, oh, I haven't felt that way since I was 4 or 5. And that's one of the things that happened for me, is that as I started sitting, meditating more, I started having a sense of well-being that I hadn't felt since I was a little kid. And so, oh, I know this. I recognize this. And so it's kind of a little bit of a homecoming, but it was a little bit like the busyness of life, the challenges of life, all the different preoccupations that I'd slowly acquired and built up and made a whole, you know, complicated world for myself and to live in. It wasn't so dramatic. It wasn't like I even knew I was doing it. But as I meditated and got and just simply kind of stayed with the breathing, let go of my thoughts, came to the breathing, sat up quietly, slowly, these things receded far enough away that I started to experience myself in a radically different way than I had before. And one of the consequences of that is that when some of the things came back, which they almost always did, the usual daily tendencies I had, the attachments I had, the selfishness I had, the conceits I had, the stories I had about myself and others and all that, that they started to come back, some of them just didn't seem to be so important anymore or valuable or even healthy to have. And there became a desire to let go of them, not live by them anymore. And some of them I was able to put down. Some of them I changed the way I lived so I wouldn't be caught in them as much as I had before, because the lifestyle that I was living supported certain attachments. So I shifted my lifestyle so those attachments wouldn't be so easily supported. As this practice deepened then for me, then it became not clear that the letting go that sometimes happened on its own without me trying to do it was something that I could also sometimes choose to do. And so I learned to let go of certain things. And some of the things were things of the world which were not healthy to do. But some of what I learned more and more was it wasn't about the world and anything in the world. It was really letting go of the clinging, the holding in the mind. And that was a big revelation, to realize that that's where the real issue is, to let go of how I was holding on. And the advantage of seeing that is then you don't have to let go of things in the world unless they're unhealthy. Some people who are into this Buddhist practice and letting go, let go of things that shouldn't be let go of. But what we can do is, rather than clinging to them, some things we can keep, but we hold them with an open hand. And the advantage of holding things with kind of the equivalent of an open hand is that some things are worth keeping, appropriate to care for and have in our lives, and there's no need to let go of them. They're valuable. But reality sometimes has other ideas. And sometimes they go anyway. And then, if we're not holding on tight, it's a lot easier when things go. And so it wasn't your choice to have them go. It wasn't because you wanted them to go. Maybe the opposite, you didn't want them to go. But still, with this life that we live, sometimes they go. You know, people die. All kinds of things just happen. We don't know when the San Andreas Fault is going to blow here in California, right? And if it goes, there's a lot of changes coming about here in California. And I bet. And so things will go away. But the freedom from clinging makes a huge difference how we navigate that then and how we work with the changes in life. So we learn to let go, but we come to a point in this practice that we do, Buddhist practice, where it's clear that we have to stop doing the letting go. Because letting go can still represent having control. You're in charge. I'm the one who's letting go. And that can only go so far before we feel that it doesn't make sense to do that anymore. It's actually not possible anymore. One of the places, it's kind of like one of the places of holding on is control. And to let go of control is to stay in control, in a paradox. So at some point you have to, so the letting go becomes, at some point in practice, it becomes letting be, allowing. And this can feel like a very profound part of practice, especially when practice is quite settled and strong, that there's a form of letting go that involves no letting go at all, but just letting it be. It's kind of like stepping back and having a wide, spacious perspective of the situation, or of ourselves, what's going on, and learning how not to be troubled, irritated by what's happening. Even our clinging, we let it be. We allow it. Because to constantly be involved in letting go of our clinging is to somehow be going in the wrong direction, which becomes clear as we go along. It's kind of like sanding rough wood. You sand it with coarse sandpaper first, but then you have to stop using the coarse sandpaper to use finer and finer and finer sandpaper. And at some point, if you keep using sandpaper, it doesn't work. You have to just use a cloth. And so the same thing, letting go, letting go, letting go, it can work for a period of time until it's no longer the right grain of sandpaper, the right grain of activity. And at some point, letting be, allowing, and letting go of control, then something, that only then can release happen. Release is very different than freedom. We can talk about fighting for our freedom, asserting for our freedom, demanding our freedom. Release, you can't fight for release, for your own release. You can't fight for the release of the heart, release of the mind. You can't lobby for it. You can't assert it. It involves an allowing. We let go enough to be and allow for something that's not in our control. And this point where different people in practice come to this place of letting go of control at different points. Some people are really early, they're struggling with this. Some people it's quite well advanced in their practice. But at some point, the idea of the controlling, of course, trying to control so everything is safe, controlling so that, you know, I get what I want, controlling so that I know certainty, and trying to avoid uncertainty. It's many things we're trying to avoid with control. Avoid feeling our fear, our distress. We have to let go. And then that makes room for something to happen that's not our doing. All we have done is put the conditions in place for it, a deeper release. In that, the deeper this letting go happens, the deeper this release happens, it influences the other movement of practice, which is I'm referring to as interest, commitment, and vow. That as we practice, there's interest in the beginning, and then somehow the practice begins to show that it works. Something begins shifting and changing in us. And for each person, that shift and change is a little bit different. It's very personal. But at some point, we recognize, oh, I'm different because of this. And one way to some people to recognize this, if they're able to meditate every day for some time, maybe for a few years, or even 6 months, to make it maybe more of a manageable goal, and then stop for a week, stop for a month, and then see how life is different because of that. And some people say, wow, you know, I didn't realize how important meditation was, because without it, I'm not so calm, or I don't see so clearly. I remember suggesting to a longtime practitioner who'd done a lot of retreats, and that he should stop meditating for a month. And he started crying. It was so important for him. And I think it was important that month to really see what was going on in a deeper way. And it wasn't necessarily seeing something difficult. Maybe he was seeing something very profound and important within himself that he hadn't quite understood. And so there's a shift that happens. And so with that shift comes a commitment. Maybe a commitment to let go of the things which are unhealthy that we do. A commitment to do the things that are healthy for us, especially spiritually healthy. But then, you know, because that's, you know, that commitment has more to the world of what we do, where we have some control. As important as commitment is, it can only take us so far. And at some point, when the release is deep enough, when the letting go is deep enough, and we're in touch with something very, you know, very much in touch, very connected to what's happening here in ourselves and the world, there's a source for an aspiration, for a wish, for a dedication, for doing something that is almost impersonal, and that it doesn't belong to that part of the mind or the ego where we kind of ration, think things out or trying to improve the self or doing it. It's not really about self anymore, but it arises from some place that's maybe inside that's not exactly personal. It is personal in the sense that it's within us, but not in the usual way that we think about ourselves. As there's some people talk about a calling. There's a calling. I love the word aspiration because it's connected to the word breathing, like respiration. So it's something deeper that wells up. There's something that begins flowing or arising or some feeling of this is what is important. This is what my life is about. This is what I want to do. So for me, when I was a Zen practitioner in the monastery, I spent a year kind of living close to this junction, this place of the vow, of this really, what was most important for me? What was the most meaningful thing I could do with my life? And trying to grapple with it and understand it. And I didn't do it continuously. I did it every 5 days. More or less, because the monastery had a five-day week, and the fifth day was the day off. And then I would go for a hike in the mountains most of those days. And that's where I was kind of checking in and grappling with this, what I was going to do with my life and what was important for me. And what arose was something that surprised me in that it arose within, and it was like, oh, of course, this is what I'll dedicate myself to. But the decision was made before my mind said that. The decision happened in the heart. Something shifted and changed. And the decision was, for me, was to dedicate my life, a vow, to work for the ending of suffering in this world. That's what my system had come to. There was nothing else that was more important. And the vow was not something that I took on, new. The vow was simply the expression of what was already happening to me, this movement, this dedication. And partly the idea of vow came to me because at the Zen practice, vows are very important part of the tradition. And there they have something called the Bodhisattva vows, which is goes something like this. It's four of them. It's the vow to beings are innumerable. I vow to save them all, liberate them all. Desires, delusions, are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So it's like the impossible dream song, maybe. It's like, you know, beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. It's ridiculous, right? I mean, who's going to do that? I mean, in some ways, that could be seen as phenomenally egotistical dedication. Like, you know, you're going to try to save all beings. You have some kind of messianic complex that, and but it's not. The way it was understood was that in two different ways. One was there was a certain way in which you're going to keep coming back to a mind that's liberated. And so we're freeing all beings in our minds. Maybe they're freeing them from our attachments. That was one understanding. The other understanding is that, yes, it is impossible to do this, but succeeding in this then is not the point. What the point is, this is what we're going to do. This is the task. This is dedication. This is the life that we're dedicated to. And without concern that, you know, we're not going to get to that many people before we die. And so the same thing with delusions. Our delusions are inexhaustible. It's very humbling to realize that. To have this idea that someday you'll come to the end of all your delusions is maybe a kind of a conceit or kind of a problem. But to always practice, always be looking at the ways that we have delusion. And those of us paying attention to our society these days will appreciate how many delusions we live in that were unconscious bias that we live in our society, and that we're beginning to kind of slowly get a handle of. But maybe there's no end to understanding them, and they're endless. So the dedication, yes, I'm going to keep looking, keep discovering my delusions, keep working, and a willingness to look at these difficulties, that's the task. Dharma gates means the Dharma practices, Dharma experiences, Dharma openings that we can have are endless. The point is not to come to the final one. The point is just keep practicing. Just that's the dedication. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Become the Buddha, kind of? Well, it's impossible, but that's what my life is about. So I don't know if this is satisfying to hear, but this idea that vow is not about succeeding at anything, but the vow is the orientation, the dedication of a lifetime, what's most meaningful. And some people find something very clear, and it can be wide-ranging. You know, it's for a Buddhist teacher who made a commitment to this Buddhist practice the way I did, it can sound like maybe like this is what everyone's supposed to do. But no, I mean, it could be that there's all kinds of ways of living a life, many, many ways, some that are kind of not so obvious or very subtle or very personal in different shapes. There's room for all. But the point being that as we practice, we might discover more and more what is most meaningful for us. Because what is less meaningful or not meaningful begins to be shed, begins to settle out, begins to recede. And when our distracted mind, when our preoccupied mind, when our fear and our ambitions and desires get quiet, tranquil, settled, what is left in there? What is left here? What is left as being the most meaningful, the most important for us, that we want to live by, that we want to do? I have this faith that this practice we do, as much as involves a settling, a letting go, a connection, a showing up here in a very full way, it does not lead people to be couch potatoes. That's not the point, just to end up just being someone who can now happily, peacefully, you know, has no desires, no wishes, and just, you know, like, okay, I guess sit here on the couch and just smile and breathe. I think that is not possible. I think that as we connect and drop in deeper and deeper and deeper to what's here, the heart is set up, the heart has been created for in ways that are very different than you probably would have imagined if you're caught up in the social constructs and values that we inherit from our society and our families. And to discover what that is in your heart, what is most meaningful? What is the most animating? What brings you alive? What is it that gives your life the most meaning, that is enduring, that really, really makes you, helps you sing or helps something really come forth? And so that I call that the vow that we can live by, what we're devoted to or dedicated to. And for some people, it involves making choices between different things that are good things to do. I had to make that choice myself because I was dedicated in my youth to go back to graduate school to work on the issue of soil conservation in this world of ours. I'd studied agriculture and soil science, and I knew that one of the huge challenges of our world was the amount of soils that were being devastated, eroded, and we needed to do something about. And not too many people knew about this huge issue, and so that was where direction I was going, and that's still a very worthwhile thing to do. So I had to choose between this Buddhist path at some point and doing that. And I chose the Buddhist one. So that was part of what I was doing that year, reflection. What's most important here? And then the advantage of having a vow, or even a commitment, a dedication, is that you wake up in the morning and you know what you're doing. You know what you're about. There's a clarity. In this world, that's very, very hard to know what to do sometimes, and sometimes it's hard to know what's meaningful and what's important. It's hard to know what to choose to do. When there's a vow, it's like, oh, this is what I'm about. This is what I do. This is what I'm dedicated to. It's a ballast. It's a foundation. It's a teacher. When it's difficult to live by the vow, then you have to look at it more deeply. It's a it's a protection, it's an inspiration, it's a guide for a life, a purpose. And so to live the vow. And so the question is, what is that for you? What might it be for you? Some of you might not be ready for that question in the way that I'm talking about vow today, where vow has to do, it really comes at the end of a series of practice and really developing. But at some point, you might come to the place, it might be a very natural stage that you come to. It's not like you have to rush ahead now because I talked about it. But you'll just feel and sense inside of you that something is moving you. Something is becoming so important for you that something is going to shift. Some choice, decisions can be made. Some dedication. And that some of that is not a choice. Some of it is not you controlling the situation, but you're allowing something that maybe is a surprise to you to surface and call you or speak to you or animate you. And you might have to make some, you might, if you want to listen to that, it might call on you to make big choices, decisions, what you let go of, what you stop doing, and what you change and do differently. And I think that becomes, for some people, an important stage. And so what's important to keep in mind is the more deeply we go into this practice, that it's not just doing a practice that helps us to cope, manage more effectively with the life that we're living, but really that helps us to question the life we're living in a deep way. And probably most of you would consider that would be, if it's not useful for you, that if you look across the country, across the world, and how many people live their lives, probably you wish a lot of people would question in some deep way what they're doing and how they're doing it and why they're doing it. You know, there's a fair number of things which are dysfunctional going on around us. But it's also probably true for ourselves in some way, that we start questioning, and what is the calling? What is the new way of living that really has meaning and purpose and is right here? So I think this practice is that we do is not only stress reduction, it's also something that sooner or later hopefully will challenge you in some very deep way. And that you're willing to be challenged by it, because you're not being challenged by something external. The challenge really coming from the inside out. It's coming from yourself. Some better part of you is beginning to flower, come forth. And at that point, maybe, it's not a matter of bringing your practice into your life, but rather bring your life into your practice. Rather than finding a way to live your life as it is, it's a way rather to live your life from this place. Has been freed, released through this practice. So release and vow. So we have a few minutes. If some of you would like to ask questions, clarifications, concerns you have about what I've talked about, or what I've said, how this sits with you. Is it difficult to hear? Is it inspiring or nice? So, Bill, over here, I think.
Okay, yeah. So, Gil, the vow is a wonderful topic. In Sanskrit, it's called vrata. It's called vrata in Sanskrit.
Vrata, vow.
Yeah. And
vata in Pali. I'm using actually the word adhisthana in Pali. Adhisthana, maybe, in Sanskrit?
Adhisthana. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to draw an analogy with the yoga philosophy, uh-huh, where the first of the eight limbs in the Patanjali's sutras are the yamas. It's ahimsa, satya, nonviolence, truth, and all these things, brahmacharya. So Patanjali calls them the mahavratam, sarva bahuma mahavratam, which means irrespective of place, time, everything, it is universally valid. And there is a fact called Shraddha. It is faith, but faith from a very deep source, which makes people take these vows. And the power of this is enormous. In Mahabharata, there is a character called Bhishma. He's known as the one who made the terrible vow of celibacy. And the powers he gained are so much that he could give up his life when he chooses to. That is the power of these Mahavratas. So I just wanted to bring that.
Yeah, vow is of power. Yeah, great. Thank you, Ganesh. Talking about what goes on in these early Indian texts, I mean, it's so common in so many different religions that people come to a place where they already do something like a vow. And it's kind of interesting to reflect on how this is a common phenomenon in religions, or religious practice at least, if we distinguish religion from the practices. And so it's certainly worth reflecting on and considering and understanding a little bit about what it points to in the heart, what it points to in our nature, that people go in this direction. Yes.
For me, this path has not involved so much of a commitment or a vow, but rather a knowing. So I can tell that, oh yes, you know, this Buddhist, these teachings are great, and they mean a lot to me. I think they're very beautiful, and they've made all the difference in the world, in my life. So just knowing that has been a great thing.
It's a great thing, yeah. So I would have
prepared. My discipline.
The what?
But and yet there's something resistant.
Could you turn it up a little louder, please?
There's something sort of resistant or stubborn in me, so that my discipline when it comes to practice has been poor.
Ah.
So maybe I do need a little bit of that vow or commitment quality that I has been missing. So this has been perhaps
wonderful.
A good talk for me.
I can imagine that. Yeah, the knowing is one thing. Deciding to live accordingly by that knowing is a different thing. And so maybe commitment, intention, vowing would be important for you to look at.
Yes, it could be.
And ideally, at least for the way I understand these things, is in looking at it, it doesn't become an act of brute force to, okay, now I'm going to do it. But rather you recognize that there's a animating force within that is like, of course I'll do it now. I'm going to ride this wave of intention, of commitment, of vow. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gil. you helped me understand something about futility with your Dharma talk today, and I was thinking.
Futility or utility?
Futility. Okay, but turning it actually into utility.
Uh-huh.
And the image I had was of the cellist on the Titanic, actually.
Uh-huh.
And your notion of, well, you know, is it kind of crazy to go and try something that's obviously sort of futile, right? You know, you're in a sinking ship. And we often use that as an analogy of, well, that's something useless, right? Why would you go? You're gonna drown, but in some sense, what else would you do if you were a cellist, you know, in the Titanic? You might as well go play, and those last moments are your way of organizing a little bit of the universe that, in every other sense, is quite chaotic and even hostile. So, I'm no longer going to use that as a as a notion of futility, but rather, it is a little bit of a way of organizing your hostile world. And so anyway, I don't know if that's useful or not, but at least to me, that's it helped me really sort of rethink what we often think of as just, you know, futile attempts at calming. Anyway.
Wonderful. I think what you're saying is actually quite important that, some of the ways in which we respond to crisis are not that useful, actually. It might seem essential to panic. It might seem essential to get angry and bark at someone. That's like, isn't that what people do? It has to happen this way. But if it's your last day alive, is that really the best thing you can do with your time, is to be afraid or to bark at someone? Isn't there a better alternative if you have a few hours left? And isn't this the time to really do something really different in your life than the usual anger and desire and fear? And isn't that a time to kind of play the cello or smile at your neighbor or do what you enjoy, or, you know, or put your mind and heart at ease? Because now you don't have to prove yourself anymore. You don't have to accomplish anything. And so, you know, one of the questions for us practitioners is, what's the best option that's available for us? And I think there's a lot of better options available for us than some of the ones we choose. And so choosing to play the cello might be the best option for that person, given the alternatives that were available. And And so what's our best option? And it's exercise of thinking, well, this is at my last afternoon alive. What really is the best option? Then you can reflect, well, actually, maybe I have a few years. Maybe that's still the best option. And so this call, this being connected to something deep inside, to have released, let go in a deep way, and really touch something that's really meaningful, is to touch a higher quality of living, a higher quality of mind and heart, that then it becomes less and less interesting to succumb to other forces where we lose something that's so meaningful and so important. So that's, I appreciate your idea that what might seem futile is sometimes has a lot of utility, and it could be very inspiring to see. I've been with a lot of people as they're dying, and it strikes me how much of an influence it has on the people who are there, their friends, their family who survive, how people die. And some people die, it's beautiful to watch their peace, their letting go, and their equanimity. It's like inspiring. It's like people go there for darshan. People go show up and want to be with them because they haven't experienced so much peace in someone's. And other people die afraid and anxious and all kinds of things. So this ability to do this practice, to discover the better option, the better alternative, and really know it for oneself, and then choose to live by it, is this vow. Okay, so maybe one more, and then we'll stop. And then what we'll do is we can continue in the, afterwards in the parking lot. We can take off our masks. We can bring some chairs out there and sit. Any of you who'd like to stay and be more informal out there, we can continue. Yes,
Gil, thank you for this. I'm sitting thinking about the dichotomy between advocating for myself in situations where I see or experience unfairness or not being, I just experienced a week ago a situation on the medical area where I felt that I had to really push for advocating for what was right for me.
Right.
And but I also recognize where, that was very much about survival, a sense of survival or a sense of ego or a sense of just wanting to have to survive. There's a lot of continuum with that. There's times where it's probably egoic how to kind of like navigate through that sense of advocating for what you feels right for you, versus allowing things to let go.
Yeah, it's a very good question, because some things I said like earlier, you shouldn't let go of. Some things need to happen, and so being an advocate and holding your ground and saying no or insisting or staying present. And it's not a spectrum. It's not like just a range. It's more like these things can coexist. It's possible that part of our motivation is a clear, wise intention to care for our well-being, so we can care for our family or something. And some of it is that pure egotism. It both can coexist. And then it's really a pity for us if part of it is a good intention and part of it is unhealthy, to sacrifice the good intention, give it up, because there's some bad intentions as part of it. So we have to weigh these things and the impact on them and the harm we might cause or the benefit we might cause. It's a complicated world what you're bringing up. I don't have a simple answer for you except one. And the simple answer is learn how to be really mindful of yourself so you can track all the different component parts of what's going on for you and recognize the tension, the stress, the clinging, the contractions that are unnecessary. And generally, the physical tension, the stress that builds up in the system, you can generally take that as being unnecessary. And whatever is driving you that causes that stress, that probably is not useful to have. But if you can be motivated and activated, engaged in a strong way without that tension or that contraction that brings you suffering, go for it if it's the right thing. And my hope, this practice is actually makes us more courageous, more willing to kind of stand up and fight for a good cause, not less, but to do so at ease, to do so with peace. Okay, great. So thank you all very much for being here. So those of you who would like to stay for a while and chat more, there's folding chairs in the cabinet just outside in the other hall there. And grab one and bring it out to the parking lot, and we'll sit in a circle there. And we can take off our masks there when we get there. And then thank you so much. Mm-hmm.